You've downloaded an episode of The Invisible Hand, the podcast about management, economics, and strategy. For more information, go to the website, www.heronandcrane.com. I hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to The Invisible Hand, the podcast about management, economics, and strategy. I'm your host, Chris Gondek, and today I'm speaking with Jeffrey Friedman about his new book, Currency Politics, The Political Economy of Exchange Rate Policy, which is published by Princeton University Press. Jeffrey Friedman is professor of government at Harvard University. His books include Lost Decades, The Making of America's Debt Crisis and the Long Recovery, World Politics, Interest Interactions, Institutions, Global Capitalism, Its Fall and Rise in the 20th Century, and Debt, Development, and Democracy, Modern Political Economy in Latin America, 1965 to 1985. Stay tuned after the interview for more information about the show. Jeffrey Friedman, thanks for taking time to talk to the Invisible Hand podcast today.
It's my pleasure.
So, Currency Politics, the Political Economy of Exchange Rate Policy. I wanted to do this book because I am always fascinated about the intersection between politics and either banking or currency. It's an issue that I think is not addressed very often, or a lot of times it's easier for the business press to sometimes believe that these economic issues take place almost in the vacuum of the market. But in fact, there are a lot of political things going on behind the scenes. So why did you want to write this book? Do you feel that the same way, at least in the popular press as well? Or did you more or less want to set out, I guess, a more explicit situation of here's how the politics affects how currencies are set?
A little bit of both. I mean, the first is, like you, in a sense, I'm a proselytizer. We teach in the first week of international macroeconomics that the exchange rate is the single most important price in every economy because it affects all other prices. And we also learn that the exchange rate regime and the level of the currency is something that effectively follows government policy. Now, governments don't entirely determine it. The markets play a role. But everybody who works in this area understands that the exchange rate is an important policy tool. It's set in a crucially political environment. Every economic analysis of exchange rates, whether it's of currency crises in Latin America or the China-US currency dispute or the euro, will say, but then to really understand this, you have to understand the politics. And no one does anything more than pay lip service to that. So what I've wanted to do for a long time, and I've been working in this field for a good 15 years, is really try to understand the political factors that affect a country's exchange rate policy. There was a time, as I say, about 15 years ago, when I could confidently say that I was the world's leading expert on the politics of exchange rate policy because I was the only person working in the area. But fortunately, there are now a lot more people working. And I think partly because of the series of currency crises in East Asia and Latin America, partly because of the euro, partly because of the U.S.-China currency dispute, this area has gotten a lot more attention. By this area, I mean the intersection of politics and economics in the determination of exchange rates. So it's getting a lot more attention, not as much as it deserves, of course. And what I wanted to do was to propose or suggest a way of thinking about the politics of exchange rates that people could use to try to understand this crucially important, I would say centrally important component part of the world economy.
So in the second chapter of your book, you lay out kind of, I want to say, the groundwork to analyze three different case studies: the United States of the 19th century, Europe really from the early 70s on until the 1990s, and then Latin America from 1990s until some of the crises today. Let's start with one of the basic things. You talk about that any rate-setting institution or government really has to confront a trilemma when it comes to like the politics of setting the currency. Could you describe what this trilemma is?
Yes, well, this is something that really goes back to the 1960s, and I could develop it in a lot more detail, but the simple point, the reason it's called a trilemma, or sometimes called the unholy trinity, is that countries can have two of the following three things, but never all three at the same time. And those three things are a fixed exchange rate, a fixed or stable exchange rate, an independent monetary policy, and the free flow of capital across borders. And perhaps the easiest way of understanding this is imagine that there is the free flow of capital across borders so that money can flow freely among countries. So that's one of the three legs of the trilemma. Then if a country had a fixed exchange rate, and it tried to raise or lower its interest rates with an independent monetary policy, money would flow out or in. And perhaps the easiest way to see this is where it came from, which was Canada in the 1960s. This was developed by a Canadian economist. Canada shared this long border with the U.S., and money could flow freely between the U.S. and Canada. So if the Canadian dollar was kept fixed to the U.S. dollar one-to-one, and the Canadians raised interest rates, then money would flood into Canada, right, and drive the exchange rate up. If the Canadians lowered interest rates, money would flood out of Canada and drive the exchange rate down. So the point is that one way of thinking about this is if we imagine that the world is financially integrated, so that leg of the trilemma is fixed, countries have to choose. Either you're going to have a stable and predictable exchange rate, which means you give up an independent monetary policy, or you're going to have an independent, nationally specific monetary policy tailored to your circumstances, which means you give up having a stable exchange rate. The member states of the European Union, of the Eurozone, not all of them in the European Union, the member states of the Eurozone have clearly chosen to give up an independent monetary policy. None of them has an independent monetary policy. You cannot tailor Greek or Spanish or German monetary policy to fit their national conditions because they have no monetary independence. They have a fixed exchange rate. That's the trilemma.
And with the example of the Eurozone, I mean, obviously what's playing out right now with Greece, I was in business school when the Eurozone was finally being sorted out. And I remember my economics professors talking a little bit about what you bring into this book about optimal currency areas. And it just struck me, and I've done shows on the Euro in the past, that the Euro is almost a perfect example of a currency situation which is almost, to a large degree, completely politically driven, because if you look at it from an economic point of view, there doesn't seem to be, as we're seeing now, much of an economic reason for a currency union to happen between, say, a country like Greece, a country like Portugal, or the Benelux countries.
Right. So now, but it depends on what you mean by there being a political reason for the euro. So let's talk about the euro a bit. I mean, this is something you say you've had programs on this, and it's been a topic of tremendous discussion. Everybody's clear at this point. It's very obvious that the Eurozone has run into a lot of difficulty. Many of the problems that have arisen since 2007, 2008 were anticipated 10 years earlier by analysts because there were flaws or gaps or problems in the creation of the euro. So you want to ask the question, why have the Europeans continued to move forward with this monetary unification despite all the problems that have arisen? And to give you an even further question along those lines, you know that 7 countries have joined the Eurozone since 2001, and 6 of them joined after the crisis began. So despite the fact that the Eurozone is in the deepest crisis in post-war European history and shows no real signs of coming out of it, it still appears that the leaders of the European Union are very committed to monetary integration, to a common currency. So how can we explain that? Well, one school of thought says, well, it's just politics in some kind of vague sense. That is, they want to have a common currency. They want to feel like Europeans. I don't go in that direction. I think there are very explicit and specific reasons, some economic, some political. First, the economic reasons. When it turns out there was a general sense, and I think there is now very substantial empirical evidence for the economic argument for currency unification, specifically that currency unification really plays a major role in encouraging broader economic integration. A lot of the prior economic literature was skeptical of this, but since the creation of the euro, we now have some very substantial evidence that having a common currency gives a tremendous boost to trade, finance, investment, tourism, travel, migration among countries that share a currency. Andy Rose wrote an article about 10 years ago, Andy Rose at Berkeley, which argued that countries that shared a currency traded with one another 300% or 3 times as much as those that didn't. That may be an overestimate, but even attempts to bring that number down indicate that at least there's a 30% increase in trade between two countries that share a currency. So if you're interested in integrating economies, then sharing a currency is one easy way to do it. Imagine how much more difficult it would be to have trade in the U.S. if South Dakota and North Dakota had different currencies, for example. So that's a purely economic reason for the euro. But the more political reason is it's hard to imagine having a sustainable single market if the member states could move their currencies around at will, because, as we know, a 10% devaluation is exactly identical economically to a 10% tariff and a 10% export subsidy. So if, for example, Spain could devalue its currency by 30 or 40%, that would be the equivalent of imposing a 30 or 40% tariff on goods coming into Spain from the rest of Europe and subsidizing Spanish exports to the rest of Europe by to the tune of 30 or 40%. There was a direct experience of this in 1992-93. The currencies of what are now the Eurozone had been locked together for 8 or 9 years. And there was a currency crisis in 1992, and Spain, Portugal, Italy, some of the southern European countries had a big devaluation and flooded the French, Benelux, and German markets with cheap goods. At that point, there was a protectionist outcry, and the French actually threatened to impose trade barriers on goods coming in from Spain, Portugal, and Italy. Well, you can't have a single market. The conclusion becomes, in a sense, you can't have a single market if member states are free to depreciate their currency to gain competitive advantage. And that's I think, that's what I would call not necessarily a political reason, but a political economy reason. That is that the single market would be much harder to sustain were there not a common currency. I'll give a counterexample, which is Mercosur, to the southern common market that was created by Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay, and Uruguay in 1994. When it was created, Brazil and Argentina had a fixed rate against each other's currency and against the U.S. dollar. So a real was equal to a peso was equal to a dollar. And for the first 5 years after 1994, the creation of this southern common market, trade and investment between Brazil and Argentina skyrocketed. But then in early 1999, the Brazilians devalued their currency by about 30 or 40% against the real, and again, flooded Argentina with Brazilian goods. The Argentines threatened to impose trade barriers. They did impose some trade barriers. The Brazilians had to voluntarily restrict exports, and essentially, integration in the Southern Common Market stopped because of the currency depreciation. So in a world in which countries are integrated on trade, exchange rate movements can be a real irritant to trade relations. We've seen that, by the way, in relations between the U.S. and China.
And I would assume that's one of the reasons why you talk about one of the, comparisons we could look at are, you know, governments that are closed systems versus open systems, and that people with that the different players within the different systems. And particularly if you have a lot of trade going on between, as you talk about, you want stability. And I'm not, but I didn't really quite sure if in those industries that want stability in the price, is there a difference between those who have a preference of keeping their economy, the price of the currency low versus those who want to keep the privacy cost of it higher? Should we think of it, the producers all want to keep it pretty much low, the consumers in that on an open economy want to have a stronger dollar so the imports are cheaper?
Sure. So the best way to think about this is that industries vary. So there's some industries or some producers who compete almost exclusively on price. So if you're producing wheat or raw steel or basic textiles or petrochemicals, you're competing entirely on price. And there what matters most is that your currency be at a level that you can compete with your foreign producers, whether in your own market or in third markets. But there are a lot of industries that compete on quality, on service, on reputation, where products are highly differentiated and price competition is not so crucial. You know, commercial aircraft is being sort of the limiting case. Boeing and Airbus don't really compete on price. Obviously, they do to some extent. But really, these are very long-term contracts about long-term supply arrangements. And even if in something like automobiles, brand name recognition, reputation, serviceability, things like that matter. And prices don't really move around that much. The prices of cars don't move when exchange rates move. The price of wheat, of raw steel, of textiles moves in lockstep with currencies, but the prices of these more differentiated products don't. So some producers are very, very price sensitive, and some producers are much less price sensitive. So when we see, for example, when the dollar gets very strong, the people who complain first are farmers, because they're the ones who are hit almost immediately by the fact that foreign farm products are now a lot cheaper in dollar terms. But you don't really hear Boeing complain very much because they've got these very long-term contracts and the movements of the dollar from 1 month or one quarter to the next are not going to affect them that much. And that's one of the things I try to capture in talking about the differences among countries and across eras, is that different firms, different industries are going to have different preferences over both the stability of the exchange rate and the level of the exchange rate.
people who've listened to this show for a while, I've been doing it now almost 10 years, know that I have a marked enthusiasm for American financial history. And James Grant's been on the show multiple times. We did the Lords of Finance, looking at what stuff. So your discussion of that period in between the end of the Civil War, basically the fight over the gold standard,
right,
was a different perspective than I had gotten from some other books. And, you know, before we started doing this interview, we were talking a little bit about baseball, and I cannot come away after doing this show for as long as I have to think that, you know, there's the old saying about baseball is it must be a great game to survive the people that own it. You know, the American economy must be absolutely fantastic to survive the monetary and banking policies we've had through more or less most of our history.
Absolutely.
The fight for the gold standard is absolutely fascinating, but what did it have to do with this book? Why were you so interested in seeing how America got off greenbacks from the Civil War and finally got back on the gold standard? And just as a bit of, this was not, if, you know, the gold standard certainly at its point, if the golden era, say from 1890 to the beginning of the First World War, is often kind of put up as this paradigm. But not only was it not really everywhere, but it was still controversial even within the countries that were on the gold standard. It wasn't, oh yeah, this is perfect. There were still arguments going on.
Absolutely. The gold standard was probably the single most controversial national, political, or economic issue in the United States from the Civil War, so even until the 20s. It was highly controversial. And in some sense, when we think today about debates over globalization, that was a little bit what debates over the gold standard looked like in the 19th and early 20th century. If you believe that the future of your country depended entirely on how tightly integrated it was in the rest of the world and how much it imbibed the principles of European liberal economic order and the leadership of Great Britain and the gold standard and London financial markets, and then you were for gold. And you were sort of, in our current terms, pro-globalization. But if you thought differently, then the gold standard was a really, really hot political topic. Every country in the world had debates over the gold standard, including Great Britain, which had been on gold since 1717. But the most vitriolic and, in some ways, most important debates were those that went on in the United States between the 1860s and the 1890s. We fought four presidential elections over the gold standard, and it remained a very hot topic until the 1920s. I could talk forever about the gold standard, but you asked a specific question, which is, why was it relevant to this book? I would say it was relevant for two reasons. First of all, because the politics of the gold standard is very, very similar to the politics of exchange rate policy today. The gold standard was a choice of a fixed exchange rate regime, which meant giving up a national monetary policy in the interests of encouraging global economic, financial, commercial integration. So countries that chose to go on to and stay onto the gold standard were doing something very similar to what countries that chose to go on to and stay in the euro have done. In fact, people have often said that the closest single comparison that we have to the eurozone today is the gold standard before 1914. So these are very similar problems, very similar choices that governments and groups within countries face. So that's the first reason. The second reason is that for someone like me who wants to understand the politics of exchange rate policy, we know an enormous amount about the politics of the gold standard in the U.S. There were hundreds and hundreds of votes taken in Congress over the gold standard. There were votes taken over how much currency the Treasury should emit, about what the value of the dollar should be, about whether we should go back to gold or not, or whether we should come off of gold or not. If we came off gold, over where the exchange rate should be set. Virtually every component part of what we would now call national monetary and exchange rate policy was voted upon at some point by the U.S. Congress between 1865 and 1896. And so I was able to go back and look at the socioeconomic characteristics of the congressional districts, of the states, of the constituents, of the interest groups, and try to see how the economic interests at play in 1869 or 1873 or 1896 played out in the political arena. And in particular, I had a sort of a theory that you alluded to in the second chapter of the book, which I was evaluating against the American data. And I have to say that theory, as you said, it has implications that are not what you would read in a normal economic history textbook about the gold standard.
Were you surprised? I mean, after reading your talk about the gold standard in the 19th century, and I hadn't thought, obviously, I hadn't thought about it nearly in depth as you, but if you think about all the political interests, the agrarian interests, the populist movement, the fact that the railroads, who were huge economic players in the late 19th century, were all more or less kind of against going back on a fixed standard, were you surprised? I got a sense that really that part of the 19th century, that there seemed to be perhaps more numbers in the country against it, but there were individuals who had quite a bit of power, essentially the Eastern money, and particularly some presidents, who were quite keen on going back to the gold standard, even if there were political repercussions through the rest of the country.
Absolutely. There was never a majority in Congress in favor of going back to gold. Never. So how did it happen? What happened was in 1874, which was a midterm election, the Republicans lost the midterm election. Now, as you say, President Grant and the executive, and some people would say, well, the executive was close to Wall Street. Wall Street wanted to go on to gold. For whatever reasons, we might say the executive simply understood better or had the interests of the country more. The executive, President Grant, and the Secretary of the Treasury desperately wanted to get us onto gold. The Republicans lost the midterm election, and you had all these lame duck congressmen. And this is an era in which politics was all about patronage. So the executive, the President Grant and his guys, went to the congressmen who had been voted out of office and say, we're giving you no patronage. We're not going to find, you know, postmaster general offices for you unless you vote this gold standard bill through. And so a lame duck Congress, which was out of office 2 weeks later, voted the gold standard through. The president signed the bill. And at that point, it was veto-proof. So they could. So the Gold Standard Act was repealed dozens of times, but the president always vetoed that repeal, and the Congress could not get the two-thirds votes necessary to override the veto. So you're absolutely right that the gold standard, we don't have public opinion surveys from the 1860s and 70s or the 1890s, but I'm pretty sure that public opinion surveys would have indicated that the gold standard was extremely unpopular with the average American, but it went through. So, you know, you could say, well, it was the power of Wall Street, it was the power of the president, power for special interests, to some extent, the influence of Great Britain. You know, there are these political cartoons from the era, from the anti-gold standards forces, showing this, you know, multi-armed octopus based in London with the Queen of England and the City of London and the London bankers and the Rothschilds strangling the American farmers. So this sense that British financial, monetary, commercial hegemony was in some sense determining the fate of America's economic policy was very widespread. And to some extent, there's a little bit of truth to it, because if you're an American banker or an American commercial actor, a trader, an importer, an exporter, London's where the action is. And if you're J.P. Morgan, I mean, remember, American international banks in the 1870s, 80s, 90s, they weren't lending money. They went to London and convinced British investors to invest in the U.S. And there wasn't a British investor who was going to invest a cent in the U.S. if we weren't on gold. So American international banking would have been out of business if we hadn't been on gold. And so you could intuit that there's some special interest politics at play here as well.
You know, I want to leave listeners with two things. One from your book, and one that we're talking about this is, one, you know, we'd learn in high school, if we're paying attention to high school history, the famous William Jennings Bryan Cross of Gold speech,
right,
which specifically did this. But I never really thought about it until I read the book that he was the Democratic nominee to a large degree because Grover Cleveland couldn't run again because of the gold standard, because he was in favor of it, and the Democratic Party was not going to have somebody in favor of the gold standard be there. That was a vote loser as far as they were concerned. And the second thing, just we're talking about 1920s, but really, you know, that quiz time to the end, it made me think about that Roosevelt used to infuriated – the FDR infuriated the bankers by basically kind of picking what he thought the dollar should be at on a gold thing on a particular day just for whatever. So it's weird to see that this was really – it's just interesting from a historical point of view to see how many times this had played out in ways that we might not necessarily think about. And sorry, one other thing, is the other thing you think about high school history, they tell you, oh, well, the United States really industrialized after the Civil War was a massive beginning of industrialization. Then all through the second half of the 19th century, there was massive factories. But if you look at it economically, and you pointed to that in your book, really, the American economy overall during that second half of the 19th century overall was not in the good shape. There were a lot of depressions. There were a lot of people that were out of work to some degree because people thought that the gold standard was depressing economic activity in the U.S.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the gold standard was this crucial issue precisely because there was a lot of feeling that it was constraining American economic growth. You know, people don't recognize, if you go back and read Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz's massive tome on the monetary history of the United States, Friedman was extremely hostile to the gold standard. I mean, he pointed out, and then later in his life, right before he died, he did a couple of articles along these lines. And he, you know, his conservative credentials are impeccable, but he said, look, the U.S. tied itself to a level of the gold, to a level of the exchange rate and to the gold standard in a way that probably reduced our national growth rate by 1% a year for 30 years. There was no reason for it. It was a fetishistic kind of view that gold was somehow magical. And so he had the view that, that tying our economy to gold was a tremendous mistake. And he was not alone. I mean, this was a very common view held in this period. Nonetheless, we stayed on gold until 1933, 1934. And when President Roosevelt finally took us off gold and started depreciating the dollar in order to try to restore the competitiveness, especially of American farmers, but of industry more generally, his Secretary of the Treasury said under his breath at that cabinet meeting, this is the end of Western civilization as we know it.
I want people to go out and get this book, so I'm going to jump ahead because the chapters, the middle section of the euro and the stuff on Latin America is just gold. But I want to bring into maybe some things that weren't talked about in the book that weren't the case studies. And my other bugaboo, people know this, is China. The fact that, and by bugaboo, I don't mean I admire what the Chinese have done, but I've always been a little bit of a China bear because I'm just a believer that they must have screwed up the price mechanism somewhere in their system in order to get the growth and everything that they've had.
Right.
But obviously, we're seeing moves right now. And again, we talked about this on the show before with other guests, that the degree that the renminbi is now trying, that perhaps they're trying to maneuver this to be an, I want to say, the successor to the dollar is the world economy. You're seeing the whole thing with the Asian Reinvestment Bank, the Asian Development Bank that they're coming up with, et cetera. China's current economic policy, you talked briefly about the comparison between how Latin American currencies tend to be overvalued, but there tends to be Eastern Asian currencies tend to be undervalued, again, because probably export things and things like that. Can you give us just a quick snapshot of what you see China doing in the next, say, 10 years? And given the fact that we also have talked about the show, that there are definitely political issues within China that is affecting their, beyond just, you know, people staying in power and the central committee, that there are political reasons on the ground that they have to keep the renminbi at certain levels.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing to keep in mind, as you alluded to, is that for almost 30 years now, and especially in the last 15 years, Chinese economic policy has followed a path that was, in some sense, preceded by Korean and Taiwanese economic policy and Japanese economic policy, which is throwing all of the resources possible into the production of manufactured exports. And a crucial component part of that strategy was to have a very undervalued currency. So you can't argue with success. I mean, you can, but in this case, the success of the Chinese strategy is undeniable. They, with a very undervalued renminbi, have been able to flood the world with their products and to grow really more rapidly than anyone would have imagined possible. But there are costs, and this gets to the politics that you're talking about before. One obvious cost is that people get angry at them, people in the rest of the world get angry at them, and they face complaints by the U.S. as being a currency manipulator or other countries. But there are also costs domestically, because undervaluing your currency is effectively reducing the purchasing power of your own population. So keeping an undervalued currency is making a choice but in favor of your producers at the expense of your consumers. So this is of a piece with broader Chinese policy. The Chinese have discouraged consumption domestically and encouraged investment in the export sector. And their exchange rate policy is precisely in line with this. Now, that has given them great success. But as time has gone on, and especially over the last 10 years, there are many, many indications that there is a social cost and, in some sense, a political cost, that there are many people in China, especially the 200 million or so people in the enormous Chinese middle class, who are saying, why are we not realizing the full fruits of our labor? We have an economy that has grown 10% a year for the last 25 years. Our incomes haven't grown at that pace. Our incomes have lagged very substantially behind the growth of the Chinese economy. Investment has grown, exports have grown, but consumption as a share of of the economy has continually declined. So why aren't we being allowed to realize and consume the fruits of our labor? And that's the kind of pressure, the kind of social and potentially even political pressure that the Chinese government faces. And they're very aware of it, as far as I can tell. I think they have been talking for 5 years now about trying to reorient the Chinese economy away from such a tremendous reliance on the export sector towards the domestic economy. But you can't turn an economy of 1.2 billion people around on a dime. You know, you've got an economy and a political economy that has been completely and totally oriented towards producing manufactured goods for exports for 35 years. The political structure is dominated by the export sector. Regionally, these coastal areas dominate because the Central Committee and policymaking in China. And to suddenly turn that around and say, okay, now we're going to focus on infrastructure, housing, the interior, farming in these remote regions, and turn resources away from the export sector, that's a very difficult thing to do politically. And it is, I think the Chinese leadership is in some sense walking a tightrope as they try to figure out how to change the direction of the Chinese economy, which also implies changing the direction of the Chinese currency and allowing it to appreciate in value while maintaining social and political stability. That's the challenge they face over the next 10 years. It is not going to be easy for them.
Jeffrey Frieden, the author of Currency Politics, the Political Economy of Exchange Rate Policy. And again, I cannot state, I thought you gave one of the best explanations of the inflation tax I've ever read in a book. It's a really great book, incredibly well written. A big fan of this. Thank you so much for being on the Invisible Hand podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
All right. I actually do have the next show lined up. I am waiting to hear back from one of the authors. I'll go on and tease it. Hopefully it will happen. They'll go back and get to me. I'll be speaking with Charles Calamaris or Stephen Haber about their book Fragile by Design, The Political Origins of Banking Crises and Scarce Credit. Don't forget, the Invisible Hand podcast is on iTunes, and you can always like or leave a comment about the show, which I always appreciate. Also on Facebook, www.facebook.com/theinvisiblehandpodcast. You can follow me on Twitter, where I'm at Chris Gondek, or if you want to just email me at cgondek@heroncrane.com. That's cgondek@heroncrane.com. The theme music, as always, was composed by Ed Wiggers. I am Chris Gondek. I am the producer and host of the show. Keep downloading and listening. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Invisible Hand. The Invisible Hand is a production of Heron and Crane. For more information, go to the website, www.heronandcrane.com. Copyright 2015, Heron and Crane, all rights reserved.